Hi, I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich, and you've landed on the Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of November 8th, 2013. Smart move. This show is about you. It's about the choices that you make in life and how you can get more out of those choices. Now, not just more money, but more value. Join us online at marketplacemoney.org. This week in How We Live Money, it's a question I hear from many of you now more than ever. And it's actually much more of a comment. It's, I hate my bank. Well, will robots help? Not really, probably, but in-person tellers may be becoming a thing of the past. Bank of America is now testing virtual bankers at one of its New York branches instead of a live teller behind the glass. Now, these ATM-style stations, they're going to have video screens, which link you to a live person, but that person is someplace else. Now, it's still a person, so why the change? Well, video screens take up much less real estate, saving the bank some bucks. Plus, a single teller can service multiple branches. So Bank of America says it will open up 5 more branches by the end of this year: Charlotte, Boston, Moore, New York. So in the first part of today's show, we're going to take a look at how retail banking, your banking, is being reinvented, both by big banks and brand new digital upstarts. We've asked Marketplace reporter Mark Garrison to help us get this convo going. Hey, Mark.
Hello, Carmen.
So what is going on? Are they the only ones doing this, Bank of America, or what is everybody doing around the country to bring in all the tech?
Lots of banks are playing around with this stuff, big banks and small banks. But basically, the bank branch, as you know it, is going away, and the bank tellers, as you know them, are also going away. They're not dying, but the concept that a lot of banks are playing around with, it's much smaller. There's no vault, and there's no teller line like you're used to. So instead, there may be tellers with tablets strapped to their wrists. And I mean literally strapped to their wrists. This was the case of Bank of America, also Wells Fargo. So it has this kind of creepy cyborg thing to it. And they are around. There are still people. They haven't totally disappeared. But they are there. You know, you're not approaching a window and talking to them through glass like you're normally there. But ultimately, you need to get service in these smaller branches at an ATM, either a regular ATM or one of the new ATMs with the video teller screens.
Okay, so, but these changes in terms of the customer experience, you know, customers have been very vocal about how unhappy they are that we now have so many fees. So this seems like kind of pulling out on the service end, but charging you more to bank anyway.
Well, there are still going to be some of those fees. It's not like, oh, they're saving money on these smaller branches. They're passing the savings on to us. That's not always going to happen.
Right.
But, you know, it really depends on whether this is good for you as a customer or bad for you. If you are comfortable with technology, you're probably going to like these because you can do some things at ATMs that you can't do before. Most of the time at an ATM, you can only get 20s, but you can't get some singles because you want to have some small bills.
Quarters.
Not have to be, yeah, you can't get quarters to pay your tolls or pay the parking meter. But the new enhanced ATMs, they can do that. If you forget your ATM card, you can just, you know, scan your license into it and they can do that for you. The kind of things you would normally have to wait online and go to a teller to do, you can do at these new ATMs. Now, obviously, if you are a bank teller, your job is going to change. So they have an issue. And also, if you're not as comfortable with technology, maybe you're older, or maybe you just like, at any age, you just like talking to a human across from each other, like you and I are talking right now. Maybe you like that. That's going to be not going away, but it's going to be maybe harder for you to find because there will be fewer of those kind of branches in the future, and this is happening gradually.
So basically, real people will be a luxury here. But here's another barrier in terms of technology. A lot of folks have security concerns. They really are worried when a real person is behind that glass and doing the transaction for you, even though there are many more places to get robbed in that way. People are very they're very ambivalent about, okay, is this a secure transaction?
Well, I would say that comes up for an ATM, for mobile. And I think really whether you choose a big bank or a small bank or a new online bank, ultimately security comes down to you. And you need to practice safe data like you do in every other part of your online life. So you choose a secure password, change it frequently, don't do any transactions over open Wi-Fi. But if you like, you know, doing banking with technology, if you like maybe mobile banking as well, there are a lot more options for you right now. There are smaller banks, online startups, there are are community banks who are competing, and they may offer you an account without fees, you know, free checking the way it used to be. They may actually offer you an account that gives you a little interest, which is pretty hard to find right now.
Oh, my goodness. So, well, you've got me with that one.
Yeah, so there is competition now. So if you're okay with not having access to a branch, if you're okay with technology, it can be good for you.
And you mentioned mobile in the future. In the future, all of our banks will be in our phones and on the cloud.
Well, I'm actually hoping for hologram tellers, kind of a Princess Leia kind of thing.
So cool.
I did actually ask a few banking execs about that, and they said they can't promise that anytime soon.
If they make my ATM into an R2-D2, I am right there. That's all I have to say. You've
3D.
Got my money.
Yeah, I definitely want 3D.
You've got my money.
So we've got banks basically trying to move people further into ways of doing transactions that are cheaper for them. And
right.
Sometimes those will be easier for us, but not always.
As long as they pass on some of those savings. Mark Garrison, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Carmen.
What are other hot money headlines from this week? Go to Marketplace Money to check them out, marketplacemoney.org. Claudia wrote in to say, I used to run errands with me mom. We'd go through the drive-through teller at the bank, and it always fascinated me how my mom was given money by the nice lady inside. How poignant. But how 1900s. Today, as Marketplace's Mark Garrison just mentioned, the banking experience is completely being rebuilt. Now, one bank has done it from the ground up. Josh Reich founded Simple with Shamir Kakal in Portland, Oregon. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Thanks for having me, Carmen. Good to speak with you.
Now, Josh, I noticed one thing, that when it comes to describing Simple and what it does, you don't particularly want me to say bank, do you?
No, you can say bank. We think of ourselves really as a branchless banking service. You know, customers get the Simple card, they get access to ATMs. But what we really do is provide customers with a really beautiful and informative web and mobile experience. We're really focused on the user experience piece. We have partners who hold our customers' deposits in fully FDIC-insured accounts, and we concentrate on technology, human customer service, and making banking beautiful, easy, and comfortable, I guess.
Oh, well, it's really rare that you hear about banking being beautiful. That's a new one.
It should be beautiful. It's such a big part of our lives, and for it to be difficult for people to understand, it seems counter to the role that banks should be playing in society.
So, and you mentioned mobility. Because
yes.
That's a big one now, you know, and a lot of even the big banks, too, are leaning towards the fact that growing number of us are using our phones, which I know even I do, let's say, to, you know, to pay the dog walker. So how is that, you know, integrated into what you're doing in terms of service and also security?
Mobile is critical for us. You know, we require all of our customers to have a smartphone. But we knew from day one that people's wallets were right next to their phones. And we wanted to close the information loop between someone swiping a card and seeing the impact of that spend on their savings goal. So you can be at a store, you can swipe your Simple card, and within seconds you'll get a notification on your phone. And you can see what that means for your ability to save for a vacation or to buy a new pair of shoes or an engagement ring or, you know, all the things that all of us are trying to save for. We take security, you know, very seriously. And the mobile phone actually allows us to be even more secure. We take a lot of the features that banks will give to their high net worth customers, and we give it to everyone by default. And the mobile phone enables us to do that for everyone. Things like multi-factor authentication and things you may have heard of. That allow us to level up beyond the normal level of security that banks provide.
So we're talking about security, you know, being one of the barriers in terms of folks going with a mobile bank or an online-only bank, a virtual bank. But there are a couple other barriers, and I'm going to play the curmudgeon here. Listen, I need to write a paper check. What do you say to those folks? Are you interested in them at all?
In terms of paper checks, you know, I still need to write paper checks occasionally myself, and the way that I do that with Simple is I open up my phone and I type in the details, and Simple will send the check for our customers for free.
You mentioned the word free because so far, now, you know, this is very counter to where most banks are going. I mean, there used to be free checking and free savings. Actually, more than 3/4 of banks, you know, used to have that free checking and savings. And now it's completely flipped. So now most banks have these fees. So how are you able to be feeless for the consumers?
Sure. Just quickly, you know, most of these free checkings came with a very large asterisk. It was very rare for people to actually get them for free. You know, I think customers are paying on average $5 to $6 a month in sort of the fees they run into. overdraft fees, late payment fees, those sorts of things. Now those fees are becoming a little bit more explicit with change in regulation. If you look at banking technology in 1990, it used to cost a bank around $250 a year in technology costs just to keep an account around. In 2010, that cost was still $250. And think about the advances in the technology world that happened over that 20-year period. Banks have invested so little in modernizing their technology, they haven't been able to reap any of the cost savings. And so one of the things that we did is rebuild everything from the ground up using modern technology, and it costs us a fraction of what a bank has to cover in terms of technology costs. And then you add to that branch cost savings, and we're sort of in a fantastic place whereby we can offer a lot of these things without the sort of fees you run into.
So, but do folks still want that personal experience of walking into a bank? And is that something that you feel is pretty much unnecessary? Or are there just some people you're just not going to capture because they need that?
Even though we're sort of a technology-mediated company, our personality and our humanness sort of shines through everything that we do. When it comes to actually walking to a branch, we think it's inconvenient. We think that most people don't want to be waiting in lines. Most people don't want to be continually cross-sold for other products. And we think we can provide a better, more personal experience over the phone or via messaging, really done at the customer's pace rather than the pace at which a branch imposes on people.
Josh Riesch, thank you so much for joining us. He is the co-founder of Simple, an online banking company based in Portland, Oregon. Thank you so much for joining us today, Josh.
Thanks for having me, Carmen. Always great chatting with you.
So what do you want from your bank? Paper checks? Tellers? Or mobile all the time? We want to hear your thoughts on how tech and banking is making you happier or peeved. You can write us at marketplacemoney.org or tweet at LiveMoney. Coming up, the man behind the financial planning giant Vanguard. He shares what's behind his attitude towards money.
My grandfather was very well-to-do and had a lovely mansion. Then all of a sudden, the 1929 crash came. The fortune vanished. And so we all started working. I started working myself at about the age of 9. If we wanted something, we had to earn it.
Plus, an inside peek into more financial wisdom. We have a story of how we live the money lessons of our youth. That's next on Marketplace Money from APM. You know, there's a whole nother world of banking out there that's not banking at all. Folks that are called the unbanked by the financial services industry, they don't use ATMs or have checking accounts, but instead they use check cashing stores that are really traditionally known for charging some very hefty fees. But with big banks raising fees, are check cashing stores really still the villain? Lisa Servin is a professor of urban policy and management at the New School. Lisa, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
So you've got to tell us, you took this amazing job.
Absolutely. It was really interesting. I worked as a teller, first at Right Check, which is a check casher in the South Bronx, and then most recently in Oakland, California, at a check casher payday lender called Check Center. And I was led to do the research because I've done a lot of work on the issue of financial services in low-income communities, but I also knew that low-income people actually tend to manage their money pretty well because they don't have any of it. And so I couldn't make sense of the fact that lots of people were using these things, and yet they were being told basically that they must be ignorant or stupid for doing that, that they must not be smart enough to realize they should go to banks. And I figured the only way I could really get to the bottom of it was to get on the ground. So I decided that being a teller would be the best way for me to understand the business.
When you walk into a check cashing place, you see words and numbers everywhere.
Yes.
It's that idea of I can see what this is going to cost me.
Exactly.
And when you walk into a bank, and since I have read that, I go into banks and I notice how sparse they are.
Yeah.
How there's almost like a doctor's office.
Right.
Which gives it this feeling of authority. Like, we have the information.
Exactly.
You don't need it.
Exactly. You know, the signs that span the teller windows in a check cashier remind me of fast food menus. Those menus that go all the way across, you know, here's what it costs for a Happy Meal. Here's what it costs to pay your bills.
You know exactly
what it is. So people will come in, cash their check. In New York City, they pay New York State 1.95% of the face value of the check to cash it, which is actually pretty low comparatively. And they pay those bills right there, and those transactions go through that day or the next day. So they're not worried about their check clearing. You know, and the other thing is liquidity, getting that money immediately.
And one of the things for folks who still can't kind of wrap their minds around the idea of, I don't understand, if I can walk into a big bank with a check and deposit it, then I have a checking account. I don't get why to pay for what you call the liquidity of it. Explain how that's different, the experience of walking into a regular bank with a check and your access to money versus the check cashing.
What the check casher is basically asking you to pay for when you cash the check, you don't have any formal relationship. They're not holding your money at all. You're paying a little bit for the risk and for the service. So, you know, yeah, it doesn't necessarily make sense if you're coming in with a government, you know, Department of the Treasury check. You might think, why do I have to pay 2% to cash that? The bank really makes money by holding on to your money. It's a completely different business model. And I think the idea that we've really been pushing low-income people into bank accounts, first of all, it doesn't recognize that banks are not so great for low-income people because of the problems I mentioned. But low-income people aren't necessarily good for banks either. And so it makes me think about that a little bit. What check cashers want are a million transactions with $1 each.
Right.
A bank wants one customer with $1 million. So it's completely flipped.
You talk about the respect that people get when they go to the check cashing place and the training that you had.
When I first walk into WriteCheck, I immediately saw that the customers and the tellers had relationships, that they knew each other by name, that the tellers often anticipated what the customer wanted because he was there the day before or the week before, at least. And I could see that that was of value. Customers tipped us. They brought us coffee sometimes in the morning. You know, a customer would come in and they would get to know what we all liked. They would, you know, ask after us when we called in sick. So there was this feeling of almost that it was a community place. And it reminded me a lot of going to the bank with my dad when I was a kid.
That level of customer
service.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's instead of too big to fail, it's too big to be friendly.
Yeah,
it really is because they have become so large. And I, too, remember my dad going to get my first savings passbook when I was 12 and how the bank on the corner, people knew each other. And it was very much a community effort and interaction in your life. So there's a lot about being nameless and faceless. But what else can, because I really think that financial institutions and banks can learn from that, surely.
Right.
But what else do you think that they can learn in order to, because now they do want to get more folks who are unbanked. What can they learn?
There's also a product mix that people get at check cashers that they can't get necessarily at banks. People send money to other countries. They do remittances, a lot of money orders. Now, you can get these at banks, but I think it's not as routine. Mm-hmm. So it's really easy to get this mix at the check cashier. I mean, we also sold lottery tickets and Metro cards and stamps. So there is a lot that you could do. You could pay all your bills. You know, I would imagine that if banks thought that those things would be profitable, they would be doing them. But I think really looking at how people use financial services and trying to meet that need instead of kind of saying, here's what we offer, take it or leave it. I think that's a lot of the attitude. And making it more kind of user friendly. So, you know, you and I grew up going to banks and we kind of know what to do when we go into that blank, sterile space. It's not necessarily intimidating, but perhaps making it easier for people to use the services would be a big deal.
And now my daughter, who's seven, she just goes to the ATM with me.
Right.
That's
exactly.
That's pretty much what she thinks about. Let's just go take money with this piece of plastic.
That's right.
Thank you so much. Professor Lisa Servin is professor of urban policy and management at the New School at Milano. Thank you so much for joining
us. Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from APM.
Carmen.
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 Carmen. Carmen, what's going on?
Oh, yeah, that's me. It's time to take your calls. Now, we've spent a lot of time in the show talking about banking, your banking, and all these newfangled technologies versus old-fashioned customer service. And it's really changing how we interact with financial institutions. Heidi joins us from Las Vegas. She is 45 and has a really fun story that some of us probably shared. It's her first experience with plastic, and it's an experience that has made her think about what financial lessons she wants to pass on to her family. Hi, Heidi.
Hi, Carmen. Thanks for having me. My parents sent me to, or I went to Belgium as a Rotary exchange student, and I had a monthly stipend through the Rotary. But my parents also sent me with a credit card that I could use in case of emergencies, and it was my first credit card. I was 18 years old. I had never seen an ATM machine before. We didn't have them in the small town where I grew up. So somebody showed me one time, I think it was one of the other students said, yeah, you know, you put your card in this machine and, you know, you enter some information and you get money out. And I was just like, wow, you know, I kind of went crazy.
It was like a magic money machine.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a stupid person, but there was definitely some kind of magical thinking going on.
And what did your parents do? Like, did they just cut you off? How did they discover this?
Well, that was really difficult because I was raised by parents who sort of felt that talking about money was impolite. You know, they were not really open about things like how much money they made or how much really big expenses in our family cost. They started getting the bills, and of course there were fees and exchange rates tacked on, so they were horrified. It was all the more difficult for me to talk to my parents about it because we were raised with this stigma around money. But eventually they forgave most of it. I paid some of it back.
So Heidi, when you talk about that, it was kind of this stigma, this taboo. What was that about?
I'm not sure, other than sort of a family cultural thing. My parents were both very middle class. When I was little, being at parties and things like that, where I would do the same thing as a kid, you know, I would ask, you know, wow, they have a big house, you know, say things about their people's jobs or money, and my parents would, you know, sort of shush me. And
at home, though, even, was there any conversation where your parents talked to you about managing money rather than the actual kind of asides as to like how much this house cost or income, just kind of the basics?
No, we didn't talk openly about money. We did have allowance, but we started getting jobs very young. In fact, I got my first job when I was 15, working in a law firm after school. So even though we didn't talk about money a lot with my parents, we learned that on our own right away, because as soon as we had our own money, we wanted to spend it on the things that we might not get from our parents.
Do you feel like after this happened with your parents, was it easier to talk about money after this?
Yes, it was. And part of it was a function of maturity, and part of it was a function of necessity. I mean, we sort of had to deal with that. But you know what, Carmen, the biggest impact that it had on me is that I have never, I should say now, I haven't in many years carried a balance on a credit card.
What does carrying debt mean to you now?
Well, it's partly due to that experience, because that was a very, in some ways it was a little traumatic. I mean, I felt so bad about what I had done. and then in other ways, it's because I do have a student loan debt. You know, that was kind of the one debt that I allowed myself. I figured it was worth it for my education. Because I was going to have that, I really didn't want any other debt.
And Heidi, I have to ask you, you know, talking to your parents again, you know, a lot of folks, especially in their 40s, this kind of sandwich generation, our parents are aging. So it's almost like we need to talk to them about their money. Do you talk to your parents about their money? Are they at all revealing about that?
Yes, it's interesting that you ask that. We are going through that. My brothers and my sister and I have had some conversations amongst ourselves. You know, should we talk to mom and dad? Should we make sure that everything's okay? You know, should we know what's going on with their will? And I have to say that some of that stigma and some of that awkwardness lingers. They won't talk about specific types of accounts or how much are in them, but they have, you know, we have had conversations where they've assured us that they're taken care of and they have all the proper paperwork in order, and you know, they're fine for their retirement.
And Heidi, that's such a generational thing. This is very, very common with boomer parents, because this is a generation, you know, and the same in my family, where you've got hardworking people who just, you're just not polite. You just don't talk about it. And then very autonomous and very, you know, in control. But then they get older, and something you want to do is, you know, start looking for signs, because if they're not willing to share, even though you can kind of nudge here and there and here and there, but look for signs like, you know, mail piling up, or, you know, refrigerator empty, or just things that don't seem the norm that might have something to do with cash flow. Because you got to be a little, how should I say, like a detective when it comes to aging parents if they're not willing to share with you.
Yeah, that's really true. And that's great advice. And I have to say that I do almost feel sometimes like I'm insulting my parents if I bring it up, you know, because they are so diligent. And I feel like I'm implying that they might not have done something right, you know, but I have looked for those signs. And in fact, my father went back to work after retiring from the school system, but I think it's less out of necessity and more because he really loves what he does.
That's great. Don't we all want that? That in retirement to actually work because you want to, not because you have to. So let's talk quickly about the stepkids. So you learned a big lesson. And for those of us who've learned some pretty hard lessons when we were young and of that age, and I am included in there, we want to save the next generation from having to learn the hard way. So what are you doing? Do you talk to them about money?
It's been really great for me as a step parent to sort of modify my own behavior and talk to my significant other's children a little differently about things than my parents did. You know, I've learned to answer their questions openly, and they both have bank accounts. We discuss how much of what they make should go into it and how much they can keep for themselves. But, you know, strangely, I think the recession actually provided the most opportunities for conversation, because they understand we live in Las Vegas, which is, you know, one of the markets hardest hit by the foreclosure crisis. And, you know, they understand that our home is not worth as much as it was when we moved into it.
Yeah. And Heidi, I have to applaud you for that, because, you know, talking to them at this point and making them part of the whole, the financial family, as I like to call it, it's a very powerful thing for them growing up, because you guys have this feeling of, you know, we're all in this together. They are less likely probably to approach you saying, can we get this game? Can't we get this, you know, these jeans? Because they realize the impact of the spending.
Yeah, it's so interesting. My stepdaughter actually said to me, she was taking up a new hobby and I was encouraging her to get something for it. And she said, "No, I think that's too expensive. Let's wait."
Yeah, now that's savvy. And you want them to enjoy things. But to that point, you know, that's the way I was raised, with parents who made us part of, you know, when the finances were tight, to let us know, no matter how old we were, that this is the situation we're in and we're in this together. So we have to be mindful of how we spend, because children really can understand that. You don't want to burden them with too much information, but to let them understand that together as a family, you can reach your goals or get over this bump in the road. But, you know, now's not the time to be asking for something expensive. Heidi, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
So what's on your mind about money? We want to hear your voice. No, really, your voice. Click the record audio button at marketplacemoney.org. Share your thoughts, your comments, and of course, your questions. So sometimes it may happen at a big family event, or like Heidi, after you go nuts with your parents' plastic, you end up having to talk about money with your family. So each week we turn the mic over to hear a story about how those family moments shape the way you live money. Today, someone who has invested a lot of his time, probably holding on to your investments.
My name is John Bogle. I'm the founder of the Vanguard Group of Investment Companies, which is now the largest mutual fund complex in the world. Our basic family motto comes from the name of a boat that my uncle had, and the name of the boat was Press On Regardless. People think about press on regardless no matter how difficult things are, but it's also true that you better get in the habit of pressing on regardless even when the times are easy. My grandfather was very well-to-do and had a lovely mansion, bought a nice house for my mother and father. Then all of a sudden, the 1929 crash came. The fortune vanished. We had to kind of scrub out our existence, scratch it out day by day. And so we all started working. I started working myself at about the age of 9, delivering papers, and went from one job to another, often as a waiter or ice cream scooper or whatever it might be. If we wanted something, we had to earn it. But the key to my life, I think, was turned in those years when you have to develop a sense of responsibility, a sense of determination, a sense of, you know, trying to be a leader where you could. And the youth turns into the adult, and they're all still here, I think. Now, I don't consider myself to be an intellectual, although I have far more than my share of intellectual curiosity. And out of all that has come this idea of two things. Nothing is simpler than owning the stock market and holding it forever. And that's essentially the idea behind the index fund. And two is a thrift. Performance comes and goes, but cost goes on forever. You know, it's so funny in this world. Odd, maybe I should say, rather than funny. It's extremely difficult to learn from somebody else's experience. You learn from your own. And that's, in a way, that thread that takes me from being a determined little kid to a determined old man. The future's still ahead and still exciting to me.
Now let's hear from you. What money lessons are you handing down or have been handed down to you? Tweet your tips at LiveMoney. Next up, it's our lightning round. We're fast and furious with your questions and your spiritual beliefs and your money. How much do they walk hand in hand?
Faith does not mean not checking things out. You can be faithful and still make sure that the person trying to sell you an investment is licensed. Faith means having faith in God. It doesn't mean having faith in man. You know?
Your religion, your faith, and your money. That's coming up on Marketplace Money from APM. You know, the holidays for many of us are about family, but also about faith. And as we know all too well, it's about one other big thing, spending. The average American is going to start the new year owing several more hundreds of dollars in credit card debt. Here to talk with us about the possible tension this time of year between religion, faith, and money is Michelle Singletary and Rabbi Dan Ain. Michelle writes the Color of Money column for The Washington Post. She's the author of The 21-Day Financial Fast. Michelle, thank you so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Glad to be here.
And also joining us in the studio is Rabbi Dan Ain. He's the Director of Tradition and Innovation at the 92nd Street Y in New York. Welcome, Rabbi.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks, Carmen.
So, the reason why I brought you on here is, you know, I hear a lot of folks kind of making big decisions, whether it's buying a home, investing, taking on and managing debt, speaking about faith and its role in those decisions. And Michelle, you and I had a wonderful exchange speaking at a conference about debt and some moral issues or morality about it. Can you talk a bit about how you work with the church and how you speak about money in this context?
Right. Well, several years ago, I developed a ministry at my church called Prosperity Partners. And the whole point of the ministry is to connect people who are good with their money, not perfect, but good, with people who have financial challenges. So you have a money mentor. And then once a month, we have a workshop. And as a part of that, we use biblical scriptures to sort of guide people. It's a Christian program. And so one of the principles comes from Proverbs, where it says, you know, the borrower is slave to the lender. I mean, debt isn't a sin, but it's certainly, I couldn't find, maybe Rabbi knows better, any scripture that endorses debt as a good thing. There are things you can't do when you have debt.
Rabbi, you have lots of great stories in the text about this relationship with debt.
Yes, you certainly do. And Michelle's point is very accurate in terms of how we understand what the Bible and what Scripture is trying to tell us about the nature of debt itself. What my faith really teaches us is that the sense that someone is beholden to another individual for their livelihood is a position that is very difficult. And there are a lot of people in our country, in our communities, who are currently suffering under a crushing debt. Our tradition encourages us to find ways to help lift them out of that poverty. The issue is about dignity. How do we find a way to maintain an individual's dignity? And Maimonides, for example, is the great 12th century rabbi, lists 8 levels of tzedakah. Tzedakah is loosely translated as charity, or better translation is righteousness. And at the lower level of how do you go about giving charity, it's giving begrudgingly or giving insufficiently, all the way up to giving anonymously. But the top, the highest level of charity, is the type that enables a person to be lifted out of that debt, to provide them with, you know, ideally an interest-free loan, to enable them to start their own business and lift themselves up.
And, you know, Michelle, we talked about this before, but, you know, I built a lot of who I am and that bio from initial debt, like student loan debt and even credit card debt that I took on as I waited tables, by the way, every single holiday to get through college. So to me, there is, first of all, there's all different kinds of debt, right? We have many forms, and we see people who just buy way too many things. But also, to be able to utilize debt as a tool to improve your station, so to speak. Michelle, how does that fall into what you work with in the church?
I believe Rabbi could probably back me up this. Those of us who teach from Scripture, from our faith, if I equivocate and say, well, there's sometimes where you can have debt, it's sort of like, well, there's sometimes you can sin. Knowing that you're going to sin, that gives you an out. But if I'm in your head, if Scripture's in your head, and it's like, don't do it, don't do it. When you go get that car loan, you're going to probably get the lowest loan possible. That's why I have to be so absolute about it. If you start from the premise that I'm not going to take on debt, and you have a faith, whether it's Jewish or Catholic or Protestant or Baptist, you may allow God to work in your life to get what that is that you need. And there may be a time where he's saying, I don't want you to do this because down the road, I know there's going to be trouble with this. You know, you're sort of getting in the way of your blessing sometimes when you immediately resort to debt to do the things that you want to do.
Amen. That's lovely. And often we don't, you know, we want to cover all of our bases. We want to make sure that we have everything provided for and all of our T's crossed or whatever it might be. And we don't necessarily allow that faith or that spirit to come into our lives because we are so fearful and the economic climate right now isn't necessarily the best. And that can lead to that fear. And finding a way to tap into some of that spirituality that Michelle is talking about is essential in going about thinking, what are those things that are most important to us? How do we want to invest our money? How do we want to give back to our community? What is the type of life that we want to lead? Do we want to invest all of our money so that at some point in a later date we have this huge fund? Or do we want to invest in our community? Into our brothers and our sisters who are living in us, and find a way to help lift them up.
And you know, I have to ask, because when you combine faith with money, sometimes things don't turn out so well. So, you know, when there is this element actually of, you know, when you talk about religion, you talk about faith, and you talk about communities that don't have a lot of exposure to financial products, that some people take advantage of faith because it is such a passionate thing and because it is used to guide people's lives, to get them to guide them in the wrong way. So how is someone to know when that combo, for example, your program through a church and money, when that really is real?
Right. Really what you're talking about is affinity fraud. But faith does not mean not checking things out. You can be faithful and still make sure that the person trying to sell you an investment is licensed. You know, faith means having faith in God. It doesn't mean having faith in man. You know? And so, but people use that as a way to say, well, you shouldn't connect faith with money because people are going to be bamboozled. No, 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 no. It can be a safe place for people to get this information and connect it with their faith.
And to speak for the agnostics out there and the atheists. No, you know, I find that when I have conversations with folks about money and where their values are, so there is a place for everybody to give and be part of a community and have the correct values. And I say correct meaning that they're the best values for you and your future and stability, to not be enslaved by debt, to your point. But we could talk about this for another 2 hours. Thank you guys so much for joining us. Thank you. Michelle Singletary is the national syndicated columnist. Her in the Washington Post, and her latest book is The 21-Day Financial Fast. Thank you so much for joining us, Michelle.
Oh, you're so welcome.
And Rabbi Dan Ain is the director of tradition and innovation at the 92nd Street Y here in New York. Thank you, Rabbi, for joining us.
Thank you, Carmen.
So what do you think about the relationship between debt and morality? Do you keep your faith and your finances separate, or do the two ride hand in hand? We'd love to hear what you believe, no matter what faith or lack thereof. Head to our website, marketplacemoney.org, to share your thoughts and tweet at LiveMoney. So here at Marketplace Money, we get all your questions and we want to answer as many as possible. That's why we have created the lightning round. Star Wars.
May the force be with you.
Oh, that's Obi-Ben Kenobi, more also known as Ben Johnson from Marketplace Tech. He's joining us here to keep me at warp speed.
Okay, you got 5 minutes to answer 10 questions. Are you ready?
Ready.
Okay, let's go. Kate asks, my husband and I owe $42,000 in car loans and medical debt. Hubby makes $96,000 a year. I want to own a house one day. My husband's family feels we should file for bankruptcy. Do you agree, Carmen?
I just wish I would know more, Kate. Here's what I want you to do, because I really detest medical debt, and I want you to find a way to talk that down. Go to www.nfcc.org, the National Foundation for Credit Counseling. Find a nonprofit counselor near you who will go over everything and see if you can talk down some of that debt and get to owning a home more quickly.
All right, I got another one. Chris on Facebook wants to know, what makes a home valuable? How about simply liking to live there? What do you think?
Yeah, of course, of course, of course. The home's value is not just its value as an asset or an investment. It is a place. It's a roof over your head, so it has that intrinsic value.
Hopefully.
Well, yes, we hope so. And I hope it's not too big of a roof.
Sarah sent an email to us. She says she has over $40,000 in college debt. She's expecting her first baby. Congratulations in January. And she wants to make a solid plan to pay back her loans. Is consolidation a good idea?
Sarah, newbie mama, here's what you probably want to do. Look into what consolidation will get you. Usually you consolidate because you want to lock in a lower interest rate. So Sarah probably has different loans at different rates. Go to savingforcollege.com. It's a free site. Look up consolidation. There are some restrictions with consolidating, so she's not going to be able to put off those loans with deferment or forbearance. So just know before you go.
Matthew wants to know, his mother is a pleaser. She'd prioritize happiness over pretty much everything else, and credit card balances prove that. Good old mom. Dad, on the other hand, has no problem saying no when he handles the money. Everyone knew exactly when the money was gone. So who was right?
Oh, this is an easy one, Matthew. I may be a mom, but in this case, it was dad.
Daddy.
Moving on.
Okay, so Denise asks, what is your budgeting advice for people like real estate agents and others who are only paid when a sale is completed? What do you think about that? Is there a formula for how much to have, how much to pay?
Well,
tell me.
It is. It's hard, Denise, to get paid on commission or paid by project, because it's not like you have a regular paycheck coming in. Here's what I would say. What are your living expenses every month? That you want to keep at least twice, three times more of that in the bank. and work from that. But do not upgrade your lifestyle when you think that commissions are going up, because nothing in that world is guaranteed. So make sure that you save, save, save.
All right, Carmen, we just passed the 2-minute mark. All right, I got another one from Tom on Facebook. I own a small business of which my wife and I are the only employees. How does Obamacare affect us?
Well, Tom, I don't know if you have health insurance. If you have health insurance, it may be another way to get health insurance and save money, actually. So, of course, you want to go to healthcare.gov, which hopefully is working right now.
Or, probably not.
Or at least you can find the phone number to call them up there. But you want to compare your own policies, because Tom may have a policy on his own through someone like the Freelancers Union. So you want to see and compare what prices you would get. But basically, small business owners with 2 employees, my goodness, this is for you.
All right. Claire, she's a teacher in Baltimore. Her salary is about $43,000 a year. She has $50,000 in school debt. This is another college loan question. She owes $130,000 on her house. She's interested in starting a small business. Will I be able to qualify for small business grants with so much debt?
Oh, Claire, I could answer this so much better if instead of giving me what you owe on that home, you gave me your equity on that home. How much of the home do you own? Because if she owes $130,000 on the home and she has over $100,000 in equity, then she'd probably be more likely, because she has an asset just in case she can't pay back the loan. Claire, what I'd rather you do as a teacher, don't quit that job. Try to start your small business on your own while you're still making money. It's the safest way to go.
All right. Almost 1 minute to go here. Another Facebook question from Elizabeth. She's going car shopping. What is the most cost-effective transportation when combining purchase price and maintenance costs? New car, used car, 3-4 years old. What do you got, Carmen?
Oh, my goodness. Definitely don't go into the 8-to-10-year-old zone. Absolutely not. Because
that old Corolla. I love it.
So much. You know what? The car technology has gone up so much. You need to get a car to be cost-effective. That's not more than, I would say, 3-4 years old if you want to get a used car. So at least you have up-to-date parts and you won't have to pay more for maintenance. Thank you, Elizabeth. Happy car shopping.
Oh, I got one more.
Ooh.
Casey on the website, she asks, why isn't personal finance taught in high school and college?
Oi, Casey, this is a battle that I have been fighting myself very much to get this and make this happen, because it's so important. It's actually something you can use.
Ooh, 10?
In about 20 states now. It is required in high school, but it should be required everywhere,
Ooh.
Casey. Let's join the movement. Let's make it happen.
Well done, Carmen. Time's up.
Warp speed. Thank you, Obi-Ben Kenobi. Ben Johnson, host Marketplace Tech. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
All right. Stay cool, Carmen.
Ah, the Twitter IPO. There is little escape from the hype around this next hottest tech stock, and I really hate to add to it, so I won't. But what I will say is this. Keep in mind that news about individual stocks, especially the latest and greatest in tech, is very much like a beauty contest. Everybody wants to meet the reigning queen and shake her hand, but if you look beyond the makeup, you may see that what seems attractive can be built on a lurking rot. Investing in individual stocks, it's an entertaining game, so let's keep it that way. If you can't risk losing money, then buying individual stocks shouldn't be for you. Except with your play money, like how I buy a lotto ticket, $2, once in a while when the jackpot gets up over $100 million. Now, is that a smart use of my money? Well, it's not necessarily smart, but I definitely get what I'm really paying for. Entertainment. So if you're really looking to invest your money for the long term, and you can't afford to lose all this money that you're investing, steer clear of the latest stock market pageant. Instead, do this. First, max out your tax-friendly retirement tools that keeps more money in your portfolio, for example, an IRA, a 401k. Keep the fees low. Again, that gives you more money to grow. Head to index funds, which don't charge management fees, and keep an eye on other feeds, also known as loads, as well. And very, very importantly here, diversify, diversify, diversify. Don't we all know what happens when all of our eggs are in one basket? Owning one stock, it's the equivalent of putting all your money on red 32 on a roulette wheel. The house has way too many advantages. Instead, choose assets carefully across classes and sectors. Know what's real risk versus what's not or less. But should you want to play in the stock market with the latest snazzy IPO, just make sure it's play money and buckle your seatbelts because it's going to be a bumpy ride. Marketplace Money is a family effort. The show is produced by Dan Gretsch, Nancy Fargali, Raghu Manavalan, Mary Dew, Candice Manriquez, Stan Alcorn, and Lindsay Foster Thomas. Charlton Thorpe is our engineer. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Carmen Wong Ulrich. Thanks for listening, and let's talk soon. This is APM.